Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here, episode 2420. I still can't believe I'm doing these after all that, but I am absolutely delighted. It's days like today that keep this job exciting. I'm so delighted to have an opportunity to speak to Larry Elder, whom you all know as radio host, author, political commentator, political candidate. And I, in particular, want to talk to him about a brand new book of his called As Goes California, My Mission to Rescue the Golden State and Save the Nation. There's no getting around. We have to talk about the potential threat of Gavin Newsom, and who better to do so than Larry Elder. So Larry, welcome to the show.
Tom, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
You know, let me just get right to the heart of things. It's one thing to have your opponents say, you know, you made a mistake on page 127 of your book. It's quite another to have your opponents say, you are a betrayer of your own people.
Right.
How do you manage a wave of accusations like that?
Well, I've been in this business now for about 40 years, and I've been called worse by worse. The LA Times called me during my campaign for governor the black face of white supremacy in a headline of a column. Larry Elder is the black face of white supremacy. Some headline, Tom, you've been warned. And another columnist during the same period of time referred to my views as white supremacist views. So one person one time on my radio show called me flag-waving, Jew-loving Uncle Tom. And I said, I'll cop to two of the three. We figure out which two. So, you know, when people have called you names, it means, in my opinion, they're out of ammo. And the worst thing that someone can say to me is, you're wrong, here's why. They don't say that. They just say you're a bad person because we don't like your views. And it's silly. It's childish. It's preschool. The woman that referred to me, by the way, as the black face of white supremacy, is named Erica D. Smith. She's a columnist with the LA Times. Happened to be a black female. And when I finished my campaign for governor, I went back to fulfill my contract for radio. And I invited her on my show to explain to people why Larry Elder is a black face of white supremacy. And not too surprisingly, Tom, she refused to come on. Over the years, I've invited Jesse Jackson on my show over 100 times. He wouldn't come on. Al Sharpton over 100 times. He wouldn't come on. Maxine Waters wouldn't come on. Louis Farrakhan wouldn't come on. But one time, one so-called black leader did come on. His name is Kwesi Mfume. At the time, he was the president of the NAACP. Before that, He was a longtime congressman from Maryland. He's now back in Congress for Maryland. And first thing I said to him, Tom, was, as between the presence of white racism or the absence of black fathers, which poses a bigger threat to the black community? Without missing a beat, he said, the absence of black fathers. And that is the biggest problem facing the black community. So you can call me all the names you want. I care more about the black community, at least in terms of doing actual solutions, than you do. All these people do is whine and grind and complain about how racist white people are and how racist America is, when it's been the only majority white country that's ever voted for and elected a black president. Black people are better off in America than they are anywhere else in the world, including all the countries of Africa. All we have to do is take advantage of the available opportunities that we have. And that's all I'm doing, is encouraging people to do that. And if that engenders hostility and hatred, so be it. It's just the price of the ticket.
Your book has plenty of material on your background. I do want to get to that in a minute, but I'm asking these questions in rather a selfish order because these are things that concern me. And okay. I'll say that one thing that concerned me as somebody who followed the COVID matter very closely, and I wrote about it every day in my email newsletter, it was extremely demoralizing. Now, let's leave Newsom out of the conversation till later, but it was extremely demoralizing to see somebody like Gretchen Whitmer get rewarded, that people who were, in effect, tortured by some of these governors completely unscientifically. If after all this, Florida has better all-cause mortality numbers than California, that's all the statistic you need to know. And then to observe them getting back in office. Now, you are not just a commentator, but political candidate. You've been a political candidate a couple times. And as a political candidate, it's your job to be hopeful and optimistic. Explain to me how I should be hopeful and optimistic when Gretchen Whitmer gets reelected.
Well, I'm not sure it's my job as a politician to be hopeful and optimistic. I think it's my job to tell the truth and to have policies that make people better off. By the way, I was just at a party yesterday, Tom, and I met a doctor whom I didn't know. He was a pathologist. And I asked him his opinion about how we handled the COVID crisis. And he said, do you really want to go there? And I said, yeah, I do. I didn't realize he knew who I was and knew that I did not agree with him. And he said, I feel very strongly about this. The COVID vaccine saved lives. I'm very angry about people who say otherwise. And I said, well, not too surprisingly, I feel differently. He said, well, you're not a pathologist. I said, no, and you're not an economist. And I said, there are trade-offs. And he said, well, I don't want to have this conversation anymore. When I ran for governor, I was called anti-vax. Now, Tom, I'd been vaccinated because my doctor told me that I should get vaccinated because of my age, because I've got so-called comorbidities. I have high blood pressure. I have a very rare blood disease. And for those reasons, he recommended that I get vaccinated. I followed his advice. In retrospect, I don't believe I would have followed his advice. But my point is, it should not have been mandated. There should not have been vaccine mandates, as there has been in California under Gavin Newsom, mass mandates, as there have been in California under Gavin Newsom. They certainly shouldn't have closed businesses, and they certainly shouldn't have closed schools. Our schools are right near the bottom of all 50 states in America. 75% of Black third graders can neither read nor do math at grade level. They lost 2 full years of in-school education, which will translate into earnings loss over the course of their lives. It was the most outrageous response to a pandemic, I think, in the history of the world. And when Gavin Newsom shut down the state, there was a specific date when you weren't supposed to go to work. Because I'm in media at the time, I was exempt. So I got in my car at the same time to go to work. And I thought, Tom, maybe there would be 50% less traffic. Because I thought so many people would say, screw you, I'm going to work. You're not going to tell me what to do. That they would not have enough jails to fill the people who violated the mandate. And after a few days, they would repeal it. I was shocked. I got in my car, and you could have rolled a bowling ball down one of the busiest streets in LA and not hit anybody. I was shocked that so many people simply complied. I was blown away by that. I didn't realize that people were going to be that compliant, act like lemmings, and follow the advice given by somebody who, by the way, kept his own business in operation, Gavin Newsom, had his own kids in school education, while laughing and yucking it up at that restaurant in Napa Valley called the French Laundry, with the very same people, Tom, who drafted the mandates. He was not wearing the mask. He was not engaging in social distancing. And they incurred a $12,000 wine tab at taxpayers' expense. Now, I don't know that much about wine, but I assure you he was not drinking Mad Dog 2020. So for all those reasons, I thought that the average person in California would say, the hell with you. You're not going to tell me what to do. You're not going to tell me I can't have a livelihood. A third of all restaurants in the state of California are now gone forever. And these are primarily the mom and poppers owned by Black and brown people, the people that the left purports to care about.
Well, that is indeed where we find ourselves. And I, you know, at the beginning of your book, you have a discussion with a couple of voters, let's say, who did, as you point out, did not vote for you.
Right.
But yet, as the conversation unfolds, it's quite clear they have exactly the same concerns you do. They're just as unhappy with the state of the condition of California. And in fact, anybody can see. Anybody can see it's impossible to make ends meet in California. The
right.
homeless problem is overwhelming, and crime and everything. Everybody sees that, and yet they keep it. It looks like they're voting for more. But what you seem to be suggesting in that anecdote you shared is that if they had a way of not voting for more, they would do it if it didn't involve having to vote for a Republican.
Right. They've been indoctrinated into believing no matter how bad things are, Republicans are worse. I think now we're worse because of our position, a lot of Republicans' position on abortion and skepticism about climate change. During the campaign, I was outspent almost 10 to 1. And Tom, commercial after commercial after commercial, hit piece after hit piece after hit piece. And they kept showing the same picture over and over again. At the time, I had had one picture with Donald Trump, the two of us holding up our thumbs. And I saw that picture over and over and over again, even though Trump did not endorse me. The Trump people reached out and I said, no, I want to make this California-centric. They're going to turn this into a referendum on Republicans in general. And if you endorse me, you'll make it easier for them to do so. And so every single commercial said this. Stop the Republican takeover. Nobody said Gavin Newsom is doing a great job on crime. Crime is up in many instances, in many categories, while arrests are down because the police are demoralized. They never said Gavin Newsom is doing a great job on schools. I mentioned to you how bad the schools are. Didn't say Gavin Newsom is doing a great job on cost of living. The average price of a home in California is 175% above the national average. And that's because of the marriage between the Democrats and the environmentalists who don't want any kind of construction whatsoever. And they're able to stop construction, delay it, jack up the price. And as a result, we have 3 or 4 million fewer housing units than we otherwise should have. On a housing unit per capita basis, we are 49 out of 50 states. And people are leaving California for the first time in 170 years. The last 2-3 years, about 700,000 people have left California. They never said anything about that. They just said, stop the Republican takeover, and it worked. You mentioned the two people that I met at the beginning of the book. These were two ladies. They were 85 years old. What happened is I went to a restaurant. I got there a little earlier than my buddy did. So I'm sitting there for about 15 minutes. And I think they felt sorry for me, Tom. So they started talking to me. And I found out that they were 85 years old. They'd known each other since the second grade. One of them was celebrating her 85th birthday. One called herself a human rights activist. One called herself a psychotherapist. And then about 10 minutes into the conversation, one of them said, "Wait a minute, I know you. You're that guy that ran for governor. You're that Larry Elder. Guess who we voted for?" She had a big smile. I said, "You didn't vote for me." She said, "How do you know that?" I said, "Let's see, we're on the west side of LA, which is very liberal. You're both Jewish, very liberal. One of these says you're a human rights activist. That's probably a very liberal profession." I said, "It doesn't take Colombo to put that together. You didn't vote for me." And they admitted they had. And I said, "How do you feel about crime?" They both went nuts. They both knew people that had been mugged. "How do you feel about the homeless problem?" They told me it was outrageous that they lived near a homeless encampment. "How do you feel about the fact that people are leaving?" They had friends who left. "How do you feel about the way governism shut down the state?" They had friends who lost their businesses. I said, "So here we are completing each other's sentences. You didn't vote for me. Why? Have you ever had a conversation with a conservative Republican?" And they admitted they had not. Also in the book, I think I mentioned, I have some back issues. So a friend of mine recommended a massage therapist. So I thought it was going to be in some office somewhere. So I'm looking at the driving to the office, to the number I have, the address I have. And it's a residential area. It's a house. So I get out, I walk in, I knock on the door. She opens the door. There's this big plume of marijuana. Not that I would know what that smells like. Big plume of marijuana. And she has tattoos everywhere and nose piercing, ear piercing, piercing everywhere but her eyeballs. And so she brings me in, she puts me on the table, she started working on me, and she's playing Motown, which is my favorite genre of popular music. And as soon as a song would come on, I would say, "Well, that song was written by Smokey Robinson, but he wrote it for David Ruffin, the lead singer of The Temptations, who, by the way, died of a drug overdose." And another song would come on, I would give her the backstory. And every song that came on, I pretty much knew a backstory about it. And she said, "You know, I know who you are. You're the guy who ran for governor." And she said, "Had I known you were this funny and this personable, I would have voted for you." I said, "Do you know any Republicans?" She said, "No." I said, "Well, we have personalities. Many of us have senses of humor. So honestly, this is what's going on in this state. They have siphoned themselves off into their little silos. They don't even know any Republicans. They haven't connected the dots. There's a reason we have a homeless problem. There's a reason the schools are so bad. There's a reason houses cost so much. There is a reason that people are leaving California, and it's policies that you have supported now for decades."
That is the first question people want to ask, of course, is how it's possible that Newsom could do a job that nobody defends, that you have a net outflow of people, and that he still gets back in. But we're going to dissect that a little bit more. I want to turn the clock back a bit to earlier in your life. Can you share with my audience what your background is and how it is that you came to hold what we would, I think, legitimately call dissident views?
Yes. Well, I'm from Los Angeles, from an area called Pico Union, which at the time was mostly Hispanic. It still is. And then we moved uptown to South Central Los Angeles. We were the second Black family in the neighborhood. Within about 5 years, I think there were only two white families left. Everybody moved out because of white flight and a fear that Black people were going to somehow degrade the neighborhood. I have two hardworking parents. My mother is from Huntsville, Alabama. She's raised on a farm. My dad is from Athens, Georgia. Never knew his biological father. Had a very irresponsible mother. He's only child. His mother didn't work. She lived off a series of men. And the man that was in my dad's life longest was named Elder, which is why my dad used his last name. I don't even think he formally adopted my dad. My dad was thrown out of the house at the age of 13 by his mom. He came home in the eighth grade and started quarreling with his mom's then boyfriend. Elder was long gone. The mom sided with the boyfriend and threw my father out of the house, never to return. My dad went down the road, picked up trash, did anything he could to earn a living. Ultimately, he became a Pullman porter on the trains. They were the largest private employer of Blacks in those days. So this little Black boy from Athens, Georgia, was able to travel all around the country and came to this place called California in a city called Los Angeles. And my dad was blown away. You could walk to the front door of a restaurant and get served. So my dad made a mental note, maybe someday I'll relocate to Los Angeles, because my dad always had packages of crackers and 10 cans of tuna because he never knew whether or not he'd be able to get a meal. World War II, my dad joins the Marines. I asked him why. My dad said two reasons. If you ever talk to a Marine, you know what I'm going to say, Tom. Two reasons. They go where the action is. I love the uniforms. So my dad was stationed on the island of Guam, World War II, in charge of cooking for the so-called colored soldiers, because the military was segregated. He gets out of the military, goes back to Chattanooga, where he married my mom, getting a job as a cook. My dad look at a cake and tell you what's in it. He's that good. And nobody would hire him because they said, pardon me, we don't hire niggers. My dad went to an unemployment office. The lady says, you went to the wrong door. My dad went out to the hall and saw colored only, went through that door to the very same lady who sent him out. My dad came home to my mom and said, this is BS. I'm going to LA where I was before the war. I'm going to get me a job as a cook and I'll send for you. My dad comes out to LA by himself, walks around for 2 days, and he's told, you have no references. My dad said, I need references to make ham and eggs. My dad even offered to work for free if someone would give him a written reference. Nobody would do that. So he's treated the same way in California, in LA, as he was in Chattanooga, maybe a little less N-word-ish, but he was treated the same way. He went to an unemployment office. This time, it's one door. Lady says, I don't have anything. My dad says, what time do you open? She says, 9. What time do you close? She says, 5. My dad said, I'll be sitting in that chair until you find me something. My dad sat in the chair for the whole day, came back the next day. She calls him up. I have something. I don't know whether you're going to want it. My dad says, of course I'm going to want it. I'm starting a family. What is it? She said, it's a job cleaning toilets at Bisco Brand Bread. My dad did that for over 10 years, took a second full-time job cleaning toilets at another bread company, went to night school to get his GED, cooked for a family on the weekends because he wanted my mom to be a stay-at-home mom. And then after he got his GED, he went to night school to learn how to operate a small restaurant. At 47 years old, my dad was able to save enough nickels and dimes. He started a little cafe in the same area of Pico Union where we used to live. And my dad ran that restaurant until his mid-80s. He owned the land. He owned some property next to it, plus the house that's still in our family. My dad died. His net worth was a little bit under $1 million. And my dad was a lifelong Republican. My mom, a lifelong Democrat. You should have been a fly on the wall to hear some of the political arguments. Nobody called anybody a fascist. Nobody called anybody a Nazi. Nobody said, you only care about the rich, you don't care about the poor. My dad always told my brothers and me the following. Hard work wins. You get out of life what you put into it. Larry, you cannot control the outcome, but you are 100% in control of the effort. Before you moan or groan about what somebody did or say to you, go to the nearest mirror, look at it, and ask yourself, what can I have done to change the outcome? And finally, my dad said, no matter how hard you work, how good you are, sooner or later, bad things are going to happen to you. How do you deal with those bad things? We tell your mother and me if we raised a man. So for my long way of saying this, Tom, I was always raised not to be a victim. My mother told me nobody can make you feel inferior without your permission. So I always felt confident. I always felt that if I worked hard, invested in myself, I could make something out of myself. So I was never somebody who said, woe is me, the man is holding me back. I can't say that made me a conservative or libertarian, which I ultimately became, but I was always one of those in my class when the other kids would whine about this, that, or the other. I would give another point of view, a dissident point of view. And I wasn't called a sellout or an Uncle Tom in those days, but I was called somebody, they would roll their eyes, oh, that's Larry, oh, that's Larry, when I would offer a different point of view as to whether or not we were oppressed for this reason or that reason. I went to an all-Black high school. A handful of people were not Black, but most of the kids were Black. And there was a poem we studied in class by a Black poet named County Cullen. And it goes like this. While riding through old Baltimore, so small and full of glee, I saw a young Baltimorean keep looking straight at me. I was young and very small, and he was no whit bigger, so I smiled. But he poked out his tongue, called me nigger. I saw the whole of Baltimore from May until September. Of all the things that happened there, that's all that I remember. The teacher was angry. She was Black. The class was angry. I got angry. So I'm walking home. And I knew my mom was going to have a different perspective on the poem. I didn't know what it was going to be. I walk in the house. She was frying some chicken wings, my favorite, and stirring a big pot of greens. I said, Mom, we read a poem in class. I want to get your reaction to it. She said, sure, what is it? I said, it goes like this. While riding through old Baltimore, so small and full of glee, I saw a young Baltimorean, people looking straight at me. I was young and very small, and he was no whit bigger, so I smiled. But he poked out his tongue and called me nigger. I saw the whole of Baltimore from May until September. Of all things that happened there, that's all that I remember. My mom took the spoon out of the pot, hit it on the side, and said, Larry, what a darn shame he allowed something like that to spoil his vacation. How many wings do you want? So that's always been my attitude, Tom. And then I studied economics. I studied Milton Friedman. I studied Ayn Rand. And I realized that I was, in fact, a hardcore libertarian. And I've been that way ever since.
I hope you won't mind if I share for just a minute something I share in common with your father.
Okay.
I had a job cleaning toilets. I was a college kid. I needed to get some money. At the college I went to, the bathrooms were all private. They were not shared. They're in the room. So I had a master key. I could go in, clean the bathroom. And you know, the interesting thing is, here I was a kid at a highly elite school, and yet I legitimately took pride in my work. I thought to myself, when these kids get home and they're all studying and working really hard, they get back, they're going to have a sparkling clean bathroom. Right. And I did that for them. And so sometimes, even if the work seems lowly, you can elevate it with the attitude you bring to it. I thought the work I was doing was really important and helpful for these people.
Well, no lawful work to me is undignified. By the way, whenever I travel, I do a lot of traveling. I ran for president, as you know, traveling all the time. Every time I'm in an airport bathroom and the janitor is there, I give that janitor a $20 bill. And every time they are blown away by it. Because of my dad, I always think about my father. Whenever I look at a janitor in the bathroom, I always give him a $20 bill. And by the way, I gave one to a black guy once. And the guy goes, "Thank you. I know you. You're Larry Elder." He looked both ways and said, "I'm a Republican. I voted for Donald Trump." And it was just, we had a nice conversation. And he said, can I take a pic? Took a picture together. He said, "I'm going to tell my wife I saw you." It was just great.
That is great. So have you lived in California since you were born?
Born and raised, yes. I went
to. You've had a front row seat to the, whether we call it progress or retrogression of California. So as, not even as Larry Elder politician or political commentator, just as Larry Elder, citizen of California, what would be some of your anecdotal observations that tell us something about where California was and where it now is?
Well, I mentioned my father. He worked 2 full-time jobs as a janitor. My mom did not work outside the home, yet they were able to buy a home and then buy a more expensive home in South Central Los Angeles. A janitor working 4 jobs could not do that now in California because the price of living is so high. That's probably the biggest change here in California. And we have a homeless problem. I live in a very nice area of Los Angeles. I welcome you to come and visit me next time you're in LA, Tom. And no more than 5 minutes away on both sides of a pretty busy street is van after van after van after van, because they're so dirty, you can tell they've been there for a month, where people are living inside those vans. Trash stacked up all over the place. And it's in a very nice area of LA. And you drive downtown and you find homeless encampments all over the place. That was never the case when I was growing up here. I used to go downtown because I like going downtown. I wouldn't go downtown now to hang out on a bet because so many homeless people there, hypodermic needles everywhere. It's just gotten absolutely outrageous. It's because of the policies here. We've taxed and spent and regulated ourselves to the point we've got all these kinds of problems. California has the highest state income tax in the nation. Its overall taxes put it in about the middle of the nation. When you factor in real estate and sales taxes and those kinds of things, the state income tax is the highest in the country. About maybe less than 1% of all the taxpayers account for half of all the state income taxes. And that's the largest source of revenue for California, the state income tax. So people like Elon Musk have left, Dave Rubin, Ben Shapiro have left, and they've taken their taxes with them. We have a $1.5 trillion unfunded pension liability because of the large number of government workers who've retired making six-figure incomes. Then you turn around and you set up a board to tell owners of fast food restaurants what they should pay their fast food workers, and they just established that. And a fast food worker's salary has now gone from $15 an hour to almost $20 an hour, not because of fair markets or supply and demand, because of government edict. Why? Because the cost of living is so high. Why is the cost of living so high? Because of policies, bad policies. They pass a bad policy to address a bad policy that addressed another bad policy. And that's what's going on here in California. And that's why I wrote my book, As Goes California, as a warning to the rest of the country about what would happen to you if somebody like Gavin Newsom were to get power. And to tell people who leave California and go to places like Arizona and Texas and Florida and Colorado, connect the dots. Understand why you left. There's a reason why you couldn't afford a house. And please don't go to these new places and vote for the same policies that caused you to leave California because you haven't connected the dots.
Hey, everybody, let's take a minute to thank our sponsor, Persist SEO. If you are getting buried by your competition online, then build your brand, your reputation, and your lead flow with digital marketing by Persist SEO. If you are a small local business trying to compete against large companies in the service industry, then increase your visibility with Persist SEO. What if you have low or no leads coming in on a consistent basis? Well, then website search engine and conversion optimization can help move the needle to a more prosperous business model for you. Are you tired of cold calling and networking, meeting places getting shut down? Use your website as a lead generation engine. Or what if you're not showing up for your services in the search engines? Well, get found with Persist SEO's expert search engine optimization. All you have to do is call 770-580-3736 or visit them at ineedseo.help for a free website audit and consultation. That's 770-580-3736 or ineedseo.help. Last time I was in Los Angeles about a year ago, and I don't know Los Angeles very well, so I couldn't even tell you what area of the city I was in, but I do recall that walking around at night, let's just say I encountered a great many what we might call lost souls wandering around, just lost souls. And again, I don't mean to presume that being a politician, you have to do certain things, but politicians are expected to offer quote unquote solutions. And the thing is, on the left, there is this general thought that, oh, well, maybe the institutions of our society need to be reformed. There's always some neat little packaged solution. Whereas the Russell Kirk conservative movement thinks, well, the human condition is tragic and some things can't be solved. No politician can say that. You have to have some quote-unquote solution. Is there a solution to those lost souls I was seeing?
I think so. I think you could certainly make things better. For example, in California, California is 6.5% Black. Tom, believe it or not, 40% of the homeless is Black. Now, where does that? It goes back to the breakdown of the family. 70% of Black kids enter the world without a father in the home, married to the mother, up from 25% back in 1965. 25% of white kids now enter the world without a father married to the mother, up from around 8% back in 1965. Now, what happened in 65? As you know, Lyndon Johnson launched a so-called war on poverty. And since then, we have incentivized women to marry the government and incentivized men to abandon their financial and moral responsibility. And the stats are clear. If you're raised without a father, you're 5 times more likely to be poor and commit crime, 9 times more likely to drop out of school, and 20 times more likely to end up in jail. The number one cause of preventable death for a young Black man age 19 and under is homicide, almost always at the hands of another 19-year-old Black male and under. The number one cause of preventable death for a 19-year-old male 19 and under is accidents, like car accidents or drownings or drug overdoses. And this is because of the lack of fathers in the home. I told this to Donald Trump 2 weeks ago. We were in his little office in Mar-a-Lago. I shouldn't say little office. It was a grand, spectacular office. And I told him that a Black male aged 10 to 43 is 13 times more likely to be murdered than a white male, same demo. He was shocked. He asked me for a source. I said, in the Centers for Disease Control, have you heard of him? And he started laughing. So that's one of the problems here, the breakdown of the family. And that is a string that connects us to the homeless problem here in California. And then, of course, you have a lot of people who are mentally ill, who are addicted on drugs. And these people need to be treated. They need to be counseled. And there's plenty of money for that. When I ran for governor, this issue came up a lot. I spoke with Dr. Ben Carson, who was Donald Trump's HUD secretary. And he told me near the end of the Trump administration, they had a plan that they worked out with the Democrat mayor of Los Angeles to use federal land. The reason federal land is important is because if you build low-cost housing there, you can build it cheaply because it would not be subjected to the rules and regulations that jack up the cost of housing here in the privately owned land or state-owned land. And he said, we had a plan to relocate these homeless people in low-cost housing. We have plenty of money for counseling and for rehab. Because Donald Trump did not get reelected, that plan did a dead stop in his tracks. But at least it was some sort of program to deal with this. Gavin Newsom was the two-term mayor of San Francisco, and he promised to solve the homeless problem by the end of his second term. Have you been to San Francisco? And then he spent 8 years as lieutenant governor of California and sat around out of the table saying, I don't have anything to do. And I said, why don't you go back to San Francisco and solve the homeless problem that you promised to solve? So note that we just had the dictator from China here in San Francisco, and all of a sudden they cleaned up the homeless problem during the time he was there. So apparently they can do something when they want to. And after saying that the problem was intractable, I guess it's not so intractable if it's embarrassing to you to have a Chinese premier come here and see the homeless problem. So I think things can be done. One of the other things that happened is something called Proposition 47. Proposition 47 had been criticized because it allows you to steal up to $950, not per day, but per store. And if you get caught, you committed a misdemeanor. Because we have cash that's bail, you have zero threat of going to jail. That's what people focus on. But another component of Proposition 47 is this, Tom. Before 47, if you were on the streets doing meth, a cop came up to you and gave you two options because doing that was a felony. Either you go to jail or you go to rehab. You pick one. They reduced it to a misdemeanor, no chance of going to jail. So they've taken the stick away from the police. So no longer can you tell somebody who's homeless doing meth, that you have an option of either going to rehab or going to jail. And so the number of people on the streets, homeless people doing meth, exploded after 47. So there are things that we've done that made it worse, or things we can do, I think, to make things better.
I'm sure you'll agree that some progressive policies, particularly economic policies, can be pretty sounding, but once you implement them, they're kind of ugly looking. And as you have emphasized in your throughout your career and in this book, you say that Blacks and Hispanics bear the brunt of these bad policies. And there's no doubt about that, because everything that these people do makes life more difficult for the poor. And yet, overwhelmingly, Blacks and Hispanics keep voting them back in. How do you break out of that?
You just got to tell the truth. Keep pounding away. I believe that the captain of the Titanic, Tom, would have taken evasive action had he known iceberg was ahead. It's our job to tell them iceberg ahead. We have to judge policies by their results, not by their intentions. Milton Friedman said, for example, the minimum wage, which went into effect in 1938. And he said the minimum wage, perhaps the most anti-Negro law on the statute books, because as you know, it prices those with the least amount of skills out of work. Before the minimum wage really kicked in, a Black teenager was more likely to have a job than a white teenager. In fact, a Black teenager among Black adults and white adults and Black teens and white teens of those four categories, a Black teenager was more likely to have a job than those other categories. Now they're least likely to have a job than those other categories, because if you're somebody, you got to pay somebody $15 an hour, and this person does not have the skill level to warrant that, he's not going to have a job. So you've priced a whole category of people out of work, all because of these beautiful sounding kinds of policies. I know you've written a lot about the housing meltdown that happened in 2007, 2008. I call it an affirmative action recession. Why? Because of studies that the government bought into that suggests that lenders were not lending to creditworthy Black and brown borrowers because of racism. So what happened is, through carrot and stick, they put pressure on banks to lower their lending standards. So a bunch of people who could just walk up a mirror got loans. A large number of them were Black and brown, who otherwise would have been perfectly happy and better off renting, got homes. Recession came along. Recessions come and go. We haven't been able to figure out how to repeal recessions. And the people that were least able to hold their homes lost their homes. So between 2010 and 2013, Black net worth fell by almost a third, while white net worth during that recession pretty much flatlined, because a whole bunch of Black people had homes. They lost everything, including the money they put into the home after they bought them, all because of this false notion that they were denied buying a home because of racism. Barack Obama, then in private practice, 1995, joined a bunch of other lawyers and filed a class action lawsuit on behalf of 186 wouldn't-be Black borrowers against Citigroup, claiming that Citigroup was not lending them the mortgages because they were Black. Citigroup said, okay, to hell with it, take the mortgages. Gave them all mortgages. Fast forward, the Daily Caller looked at what happened to all these people. Virtually every single one of them lost the homes. Several of them went into bankruptcy. One even said, I'm paraphrasing, you know, if you really can't afford a loan, maybe the bank shouldn't give you the loan. Well, duh. It turns out the banks were turning them down because they were not creditworthy. Their job is to make money. They make money by lending money. Why would they not want to lend money to somebody who's creditworthy? So the whole notion that Black people were not getting homes because of racism is the basis for which all these lending standards were changed. And that is why we had this great recession, 2007, 2008. So all these policies that people on the left are pushing and pushing and pushing to help Black people, hurting them more. And the schools are another example of that. We have these government schools, K-12, urban America, 13 public high schools in Baltimore, Tom, I kid you not, 13, 0% of the kids can do math at grade level. And they're all located in the inner city. Chicago, 52 government schools, 0% of the kids can do math at grade level, all located in the inner city. Yet the Democrats have the nerve to deny school choice to inner city kids, while their own children, whether it's children of Gavin Newsom or Barack Obama or Joe Biden, put their own kids in private schools. It is an absolute outrage what government schools have done to the inner city, and that the Democrats are not providing inner city kids an option to go to a different kind of school.
All right, now let's get to the million-dollar question here, because you of course, have quite a bit of material in the book about Gavin Newsom and your race against him. Now, this is the kind of thing, if it were me, this is all I'd want to talk about, and I'd want to correct everybody's misconceptions. And because here you had Gavin Newsom, who, even though California is a heavily Democratic state, there was nevertheless plenty of frustration with him. So I think people who live in, if you'll forgive my putting it this way, normal states, thought that meant that it should be no problem at all to get rid of him. For example, I think even Joe Biden, as bad as he is and incompetent as he is, the thing is, he commands at least 40% of the vote. The Democrats seem to just, they're 40% of Americans who are just happy to be walked all over. And I can't explain it. It just seems to be a brute fact. And so I think people thought it was easier than it actually was. But then also you came along, you took on the job. You came very close, but were not successful. So then everybody's going to blame you. Ah, well, or the Democrats or the media say, well, they blew the recall or whatever. And I know you have a million different things that you could say. But if you had like a 2-minute elevator pitch for what do you think went wrong? Was there anything you could have done differently or would have done differently looking at it again? Or was the deck just stacked against you in one way or another?
Well, I don't know if I can do it in 2 minutes, but I'll try.
Oh, well, it'll take all the time you want. I don't care.
The answer is the deck was stacked against me. Registered Republicans are outnumbered by non-registered Republicans 3-1. I had to be dragged into running in this recall election. I never run for anything before. I always felt that we haven't elected a Republican statewide in California in almost 20 years. And here's what I thought. The reason for the recall is because of what I said earlier. Gavin Newsom was at that restaurant called the French Laundry, yucking it up with the people that drafted the mandates, not abiding by the very mandates he was putting down the throats of everybody else. So people were angry about it. They thought it was hypocritical. And that's what drove the recall. And I always felt, observing this thing before I got into the race, what will happen is Gavin Newsom is going to apologize effusively for that, and then pretty soon the anger would dissipate. That's what I thought would happen. And that's exactly what he did. He apologized. And so after a while, the same Californians that voted for him because he's pro-choice, because he's attacks the rich, because he attacks the police, because he attacks spend regulate kind of person, pro-union person, pro-teachers union person, those kinds of voters did not suddenly rethink their assumptions to all those other issues. They were just angry that this guy sat up there and imposed these regulations that he wasn't abiding by himself. And after he apologized for it, much of the anger dissipated. The other thing that happened is in the first time we had a recall back in 2003, when Arnold Schwarzenegger became governor. This is a little in the weeds. One of those it's a two-step deal. The first part of the ballot is, do you want this man recalled? And if 50% plus one says yes, whoever gets the most votes on the replacement ballot becomes governor. So a replacement candidate could conceivably become governor of California with as little as 25% of total votes cast. That's what happened in 2003 when Arnold Schwarzenegger won. One thing that happened in that recall that did happen in mine is that the Democrat lieutenant governor ran as a replacement candidate. That was a huge factor because it siphoned away a lot of the votes and made a lot of people more likely to vote for the recall. And this time, the lieutenant governor, a Democrat, did not run in the replacement ballot. A prominent Democrat did not vote at all. The former two-term mayor of Los Angeles, Antonio Villaraigosa, who's a Democrat, made noises about running in the replacement side. That would have also had the same effect as the lieutenant governor did in the earlier recall effort. He was talked out of it. My understanding is he was offered some sort of position if he did not enter the race, and he did not. So there wasn't a prominent Democrat on the replacement side as it was the first time we had a successful recall. So that also hurt me. I got outspent almost 10-1. Joe Biden came in and said Larry Elder is the closest thing to a Donald Trump clone as I've ever seen. Kamala Harris cut a commercial for him. Bernie Sanders did. Elizabeth Warren did. Barack Obama did. They all said the same thing. Stop the Republican takeover. Nobody said Gavin Newsom is doing a great job on crime, on homelessness, on schools, on cost of living, on keeping people in California instead of people leaving California. They all said the same thing. Stop Republican takeover. And when you have a newspaper, the most prominent newspaper of the LA Times, opposing the recall, supporting Gavin Newsom, and one of their columnists referring to me as the black face of white supremacy, and the other arguably most influential newspaper, the Sacramento Bee, that covers Sacramento, they opposed the recall and supported Gavin Newsom. So this is what I was up against. So I think the deck was stacked against me from the very beginning, but so many people that I respect wanted me to run. My pastor named Jack Hibbs of the Calvary Chapel Church in Chino Hills, Dennis Prager, without whom I wouldn't be on the radio, wanted me to run. Another prominent guy named Lionel Chetwin, prominent conservative filmmaker, and a local activist named Jenny Sand. They all kind of approached me and asked me to run. And so I began to think, if not you, who? If not now, when? I always complain about politicians. It's easier to complain. It's much harder to get in the game and try to make things better. So I thought that I had a moral, a religious, and a patriotic duty to do this. That's why I did it. But I Never would have bet my mortgage that I was going to win the race. I always knew it was going to be uphill. I finished number one out of the 46 replacement candidates. I got 3.5 million votes. I got 49% of the replacement vote. The next highest person got 9%. I raised $27 million in 8 weeks. Of the 58 counties in California on the replacement side, I carried 57-58. The only one I lost was San Francisco, and I lost that by 149 votes. The state GOP did not support me, did not endorse me, did not give me a dime. The national GOP did not endorse me, did not give me a dime. The state wanted this guy named Chevin Faulkner, who's a two-term mayor of San Diego. I carried San Diego County on the replacement side by 30 points. I thought at some point, once it was obvious that the grassroots wanted me because I was drawing Trump-like size crowds, according to the security details. They kept telling me the crowds you were drawing were at the same level, if not higher, than the kind of crowds Trump drew when he came out to California. I thought once the GOP, state, and federal saw that, they would at least give me verbal support. They gave me neither. Kevin McCarthy, who is the dean of the House members here in California, Republican side, told the people to stay out of the race unless they were going to endorse Kevin Faulkner. So only two of them broke that pledge, a guy named Doug LaMalfa, who's a Republican in the Sacramento area, and Michelle Steele, who's a congresswoman in the Orange County area. They both broke ranks, and they publicly supported me. Outside of that, the other 10 or so California Republicans did not endorse me. Daryl Issa allowed me to take pictures with him and post them, but he did not make a formal endorsement of me. Only two did. So I didn't get any real support from the state GOP or from the national GOP, on top of the fact that we're outnumbered 3-1 and I got outspent 10-1. Aside from that, it was a level playing field.
Do you have any regrets about it? I mean, you still got the word out. I mean, you still reached a lot of people with a lot of important information.
I most certainly did. And right now, Gavin Newsom's poll numbers are the worst of his career. And the two reasons that people are citing are, wait for it, crime and homelessness, which were issues during the recall election. So I think people are waking up. It took 2 years too late, but at least people are beginning to wake up. And I know that I made a difference. So, and I know I inspired a lot of people. I traveled around the country, and so many people have come up to me, Tom, and said, because of you, I know that you were an amateur. I know you had never run before. Because of you, I ran for school board. I ran for water board. I ran for commissioner. A number of people have told me that I inspired them to get into the game. So I'm very, very proud of what I did. Did I make mistakes? Probably should have asked people to do mail-in balloting early on, because I never said one word about that. I probably should have asked people to do ballot harvesting. I never said one word about that. Our people show up on the day of the election. And so that's what I assume is going to happen. Meanwhile, the Democrats, because California has about 5 or 6 weeks of voting, had already banked the hardcore Democrats, and they were able to spend their money getting the wobblers or the undecided to vote for them, which is why we need nationally to get into the game. I don't like ballot harvesting. I don't like the idea that you have this incessant voting, but if we don't start playing the game based on the rules of the game, we're going to start losing elections over and over and over again. So I made some tactical mistakes by not saying, go and vote now, so I could have spent more money trying to get the undecideds.
Quick message from Old Woods here. It's Thanksgiving. It's Black Friday. It's that time of year, and I've got a great announcement for you. You know, I have a site called Liberty Classroom, and this is where you learn the history and economics and other subjects they did not really teach you all that well, to put it mildly. As a matter of fact, think of it this way. You look at the headlines today, they're all propaganda, they're all wrong, but today's headlines become tomorrow's history. So if you don't trust the headlines, how can you trust the history? But you can trust what we teach at libertyclassroom.com, because it's taught by people who don't despise you, who have terminal degrees, who have done important scholarly work, but who actually, get this, believe in freedom. So I'm there and a whole bunch of other people I trust teaching you this stuff while you drive around in your car, or when you have insomnia at 3 o'clock in the morning, or anytime you want. You can consume course after course after course where history, economics, and related topics are taught the way they should have been taught to you in the first place. So if, like me and frankly everybody else you know, you are a victim of educational malpractice, it's never too late. My dashboard university, libertyclassroom.com, is open for business 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. So check it out at libertyclassroom.com, because at this time of year, we've got a super, super deep, deep discount on it. So go do that. Inform yourself. Learn that truth you know is out there, but they ain't never going to teach you. Well, we're going to teach it to you at Liberty Classroom. And this is the best time of year to get it. So head over to libertyclassroom.com and you will thank the old man here. All right, last question. I'm going to ask you to get out your crystal ball.
Okay.
Do you think there's a possibility that, well, it's just two questions. It's a possibility that Gavin Newsom winds up being the Democratic nominee in 2024, as some people have been suspecting. And if that were to happen, or in 2028, where is he most vulnerable?
Okay, the first part of your question is, will he be the nominee in 2024? Absolutely not. And I'll explain why. And after I explain why, you're going to go, you know what? That makes sense, Elder.
Hmm.
The reason is because of somebody called Kamala Harris. Let's go back. 2020, Bernie Sanders wins the Nevada caucuses. And for a brief shining moment, a self-described Democrat socialist was their party's frontrunner. They were scared bleepless. The next contest was the South Carolina primary. James Clyburn, the dean of the delegates in South Carolina, then publicly supported Joe Biden, who was limping along, going nowhere until it happened. And he extracted a promise from him that if Biden became the president, his first appointment would be a black female. Biden became the nominee and his running mate, a black female. And when it was pretty clear that Dianne Feinstein was not going to be able to finish out her term, Gavin Newsom publicly said he replaced her with a black female. And when she didn't finish her term, he replaced her with a black female. I know Kamala Harris is being ridiculed by conservatives for her cackle. And I know she's being ridiculed because she was given a job to get down to the root causes of illegal immigration. If you read the black media, and I read a lot of it, they are very angry that she's been given thankless tasks like getting to the root causes of illegal immigration when the root cause is Joe Biden. And they feel that it's sexist and racist for people to laugh at her so-called cackle. I saw a poll in the LA Times. Among black people, Kamala Harris had a 70% approval rating. It wasn't broken down by gender, Tom, but I assure you, among black females, she's even more popular. They love, love, love Kamala Harris. And if it is perceived that she's drop-kicked by the Democratic Party for some white dude like Gavin Newsom or Mayor Pete, black female voters will be so angry. They won't vote Republican, don't get me wrong. They won't vote at all, thereby guaranteeing that the nominee, whoever we nominate, will win. And finally, the first Democrat contest is South Carolina. 60% of the Democrat voters are black. Most of those are black female. As I mentioned, they love Kamala Harris and they are loyal to her. And if she is cast aside, unless she wants to go, and she doesn't want to go, she ran for president, remember, and she feels she's a winner. She ran for DA in San Francisco. She won. She ran for attorney general in California and she won. She ran for U.S. Senator in California and she won. She dropped out of the race in 2020 early on, but she wasn't on any ballot. And she was on the ballot with Joe Biden and she won. So she believes that she has won. She's never lost an election when she's been on the ballot. She wants to be president. And there's no reason to believe that she's going to go, you know what? I'm so incompetent. I'm such an airhead. I'll step aside for somebody else. That's not going to happen. So the reason that Gavin Newsom is not going to be the nominee is because of Kamala Harris. Think about it, Tom. Why hasn't Gavin Newsom already announced? What's he waiting for? It's obvious that Joe Biden is having a clear cognitive decline. It's obvious that he's unpopular within his own party. A lot of people feel he's too old. Why hasn't he declared? He hasn't declared because he doesn't want to be the guy to stop the first prospective black female from becoming president. Regarding 2028, absolutely, or even 2032. He's a very young guy. He's dynamic. And his biggest vulnerability is people are leaving California. People vote with their feet. This is the guy who's governed the state for 8 years. In the last 3 years, as I mentioned, around 700,000 people have left, and they've left because of the left-wing policies. He has a more extreme position on abortion than most people do. If you pin him down on abortion, if you ever can pin him down, ultimately he'll say what Bernie Sanders has said, what he was pinned down, and that is, it is up to the woman. Really. The next question is, do you know who Dr. Kermit Gosnell is? Dr. Kermit Gosnell is the abortion doctor in Philadelphia who's behind bars for performing late-term abortions. He didn't perform them against the will of the women. They wanted him to perform. So should he be released from prison since he's a political prisoner based on your definition of when an abortion should be lawful? They never say that. So if Gavin Newsom is pinned on how he feels about abortion, you will find he's really quite extreme on that position. He's the guy that signed the legislation to set up a panel to award reparations for California. 80% of Americans are opposed to race-based reparations, and Gavin Newsom set up a panel for that. So you look at policy after policy after policy, and he's to the left of how most rational people are. He signed a bill that requires, and I'm making this up, every publicly held corporation in California above a certain amount of revenue has to have at least one member of the LGBTQIA+ on its board of directors. What is that? It's a violation of the 14th Amendment. Gavin Newsom supported that. And I can go down brain dead bill at the brain dead bill of policy. He is more extreme on climate change than Joe Biden is. He has mandated outlawing the sale of new gas-powered cars by 2035, even though most people don't want them. And 2 days, by the way, after making that edict, he issued an energy alert telling the 2.9% of those who do own EVs in California not to charge them during peak hours because it taxes the state's energy grid. I kid you not. So once people realize what a left-wing loon this guy is, more left-wing than even Bernie Sanders, he would be toast. So I don't believe he's going to be the nominee, but it's certainly possible. He's handsome. He's charismatic. Women like him. He's got that Kennedy kind of thing to him. I don't know. I look at the policies, and I think if people take a look at his policies, he won't be the nominee. If he is a nominee, he'll be defeated.
Well, as you said, that makes sense, Elder. I'll take that. I accept that. All right. Well, I want to urge people to read your book, As Goes California, My Mission to Rescue the Golden State and Save the Union, because like it or not, Newsom is, it seems to me, likely to have some kind of political future. Whether he's victorious or not, he has plenty more mischief in him before he calls it quits. And so I think it's pretty urgent for us to understand exactly what's going on in California, what his record is, so that we're prepared, so that we can dissuade other people. Again, we don't necessarily even have to persuade people to vote for us, but I just don't want them voting for Newsom. I'd rather have them not vote for anybody. I mean, I have people from California telling me, I don't like Trump, I don't like this one, I don't like that one, but I will vote for anybody rather than Gavin Newsom because I just believe him to be actually evil, not just a guy whose policies have unintended consequences. It's not that. He's ambitious in a way that's dangerous and whatever. So the antidote to this, at least in part, is your book, As Goes California. So I've got it linked in the description of the video. Also on our show notes page, tomwoods.com/2422. Thanks so much, Larry. And best of luck.
You got it, Tom. Thank you. God bless.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.